I tried to show you that the line was such that in Parmenides there is already anticipation of two solutions, the soul alone, that's Epicurus, and the soul, so to speak, either the world, and the second, the Stoic way, this world has one soul. That's to the Stoa. That's the cosmopolitan solution, and that is the peace for yourself solution, the hill, go take to the hill solution. It's eternal, gentlemen. You will all, at times, you will all be Epicureans in the deeper, say, good sense, and in the other, you will be Stoics. That is, gentlemen, these two philosophies are constant moods. And perhaps the deepest thing you should know about the history of philosophy is that it does display in its course your and my mental moods. They are not the truth of the matter, but they are great auxiliaries, means for your and my mental survival, not to go insane in times of doubt, in times of despair, in times of lying low, in times of waiting. A philosophy, gentlemen, is not a luxury. Everybody has a philosophy. But philosophy is much more a companion of life than an interpretation of life that holds water. You have to shift, I suppose, any man who lives today from now on will have several philosophies at his disposal. Because his despair will come from various directions. Sometimes he will... What does a poor Hungarian do today? He needs some philosophy at this moment. That hasn't to be valid forever, but it must carry him through the day so that he just can still speak, gentlemen. You watch, gentlemen, the end of 1,000 years of the history of Hungary. Hungary was founded in 1002 with the baptism of St. Stephen. And Mr. Menchenti, Cardinal Menchenti, by going to the American legation, ended the history of the crown of St. Stephen. And this is a very cruel millennium. It opens up with the end of the march of nations, gentlemen. There will be no nations in the future. There will only be world powers. That has been in the making. I have prophesied that this could be seen coming. You see, America delays this. You are still all for small nations. You are even for Egypt, which is not a nation. But you think everywhere there exist nations. That's just an absolute atrocious idea. Only in America you don't believe it. You have wiped out all the American nations. There you have no feelings. But in Europe you assume the nations, it's all nations. Well, there are nations. But gentlemen, the Christian nations of the Occident, they were nations because they were part of the church. They were all church nations. There can only be nations with a spirit of their own. The nations of the Muslim world just don't have that. That's why there are no nations. Syria is the only exception in the Arab world because it has Christians. The reason for this is, gentlemen, that in the history of the church, the nations became articulate as members of their councils. And the church used to vote on its last councils by nations, and these nations therefore got representatives from big universities, since the university is essential to a nation. Paris is the greatest nation of Europe because it has the oldest university, Paris. So gentlemen, perhaps you take this at this moment. It's a very tragic and very solemn moment, and just a European like myself, one cannot sleep, but just lie sleepless every night over this fate of Hungary. And all my news from Europe are to the same extent. The people in Europe are sleepless because the whole history of Europe draws to an end at this moment. And America just can't do anything. I mean, the mourning goes very deep. But perhaps you, for your illumination, gentlemen, in passing, I may say this, because it has to do with our Greek tradition and with the history of philosophy. A nation in Europe has been since the year 1000 a body of people who have a spiritual center. It's not a group of people who speak Apache or Sioux. You, in your terminology, just as you think that an individual is a philosopher, and so you break down the barrier between a real philosopher in his own right who speaks to remedy some foggish situation in his generation, you see, and the people who read books on philosophy and have their own opinions on something. Since you always mistake the others and say that every American has a philosophy, instead of saying that he uses a philosophy, that he, you see, chooses a philosophy, but that he hasn't made it. So in the same sense, you think anywhere in Libya or in the desert there live nations. That is not true, gentlemen. A nation is a unit of men plus a spiritual center which contributes something to the common belief of mankind. Any university is such a center, or should be. At least in Europe it was Paris or Salamanca or Naples or Salerno. Those of you who has taken philosophy 10 with me, well, you know that this has been developed there at some length without stressing much the result for the nations that participated. But that is the trouble with India, and that's the trouble with China. They are not nations in the European sense. There's something quite different. They're imitating now the English. I mean, India has no such spiritual center. And we're still to see, be seen how it will get one. It is very hard put. It can hate the English, but that's not a sufficient basis, you know, the hatred of the others. You assume that India is such a unit. It is not. That's one thing that is certain. And Mr. Nehru had to shoot. Just as the Russian now shoot in Hungary, you just don't like to see these things happen, but they were in the papers even. He just had to shoot. And he'll have to shoot much more in India. You are not at the end of the bloodshed there. Because he's, of course, not the real ruler of India. How do you think? 325 million people. He's an accident, very passing accident, Mr. Nehru, Mr. Menon, and all these shikes. But in your eyes, you don't understand that, you see, because you think a nation is a collection of people who vote for selectmen. That would be no contribution to humanity. Without the Declaration of Independence, America wouldn't amount to anything, and without the church, you see. Would be a bunch of people, but this wouldn't be the biggest nation in the world as of today. You have to contribute something to the common face of mankind. That's why, if you separate church and state, that doesn't mean that you can be a nation without a church. You see, it is, they are separate. But you only see now today the Congress. Gentlemen, the Congress is a very barbarous bunch of fellows. Well, I have seen 5 senators competing with 5 quiz kids on television. No, not on television, on radio, because I haven't seen that television. That was before the days of television, 10 years ago. 5 senators. Well, dyspeptic old gentlemen. This is not the nicest, the cultural aspect of America, our government, gentlemen. But what is going on in every American home? The good life that's led here. And that doesn't come from the state, you see. That comes from quite other resources. That isn't nourished by the government, but it nourishes the government. We nourish the government. No, government doesn't nourish us. Well, how do we do it? Well, from resources that make us into civilized people, you see. And therefore, I think it is important for you to notice that the Hungarians always knew this. Their pride was the National Museum and the University in Budapest. They would show this to everybody. I've lectured in Budapest as a professor, and I was very much impressed with this. When that was destroyed now, the National Museum in Budapest, I knew that was the bullet into the heart of the nation. So, gentlemen, the nation has received this power from the Greeks because the Platonic tradition that the good city has to discuss with the intellectuals from all over the world its own affairs, this international forum within a national boundary territory, you see, which you have in Harvard, and which you have in Yale, which you take for granted. you see, but which is very artificial, and which, as you know, Mr. McLeod in the State Department and Mr. McCarthy in the Senate nearly destroyed, if they could, you see. This international discussion without in a nation is a part of the national life. That means that the nation has a window into the world of the mind open, you see. And this mind is not of the city, of the polis, of the nation, you see, but is admitted into the city as a ferment and as a correcting thorn in the flesh. And this is what the Greeks have imparted to the rest of mankind, that you cannot be a nation, gentlemen, without receiving into you an article, or as an article of faith, that there must be a platform in the nation in which the nation is in a conversation with the other nations. You must always see that this is not natural. The Russians don't have it. You see, and they crush the Hungarian for this very reason at this moment, that they think they can have without your parts. You see, what is it? Oh, you are. What is it? 2 years old. Well, now has nobody a piece of sugar for the man? So, to come back, why is it so important, gentlemen? On this road from Parmenides to Epicurus and the Stoa, the Greeks outgrew their own nation, their own polis. And the eternal contribution is that they have now been admitted in the form of colleges, in the form of books, in the form of encyclopedias, which wouldn't have to exist, gentlemen. You must always forget that at this moment, in the year 2000 of our era, they tend to disappear. I have cooperated at an American People's Encyclopedia coming out in Chicago, gentlemen, in which the Catholic readers are so anxiously catered to by the editors that abortion and all such things, or homosexuality or some, these catchwords couldn't appear in this encyclopedia. My own articles have been dissected and revamped. Anything disagreeable to any reader cannot be printed in this People's American Encyclopedia. So, of course, it cannot contain the truth. Because in America, there are 160 million people, potential readers, whom this man would want to catch, you see. He cannot, if he pays attention to everybody's crackpot's ideology and prejudice. But he tries to. This is a remarkable editor. He lives in Chicago. So they do that there. And of course, the truth is abolished. If you leave the Encyclopedia Britannica for a second, another edition in Chicago, you won't hear the truth anymore. It is already deteriorating in this new edition. Don't buy it, please. It's a very poor encyclopedia, because in Chicago, there are so many commercial pressures on. You see, this group will not buy it, and this group will not buy it, and you cannot print it. There, perhaps, you see the greatness of philosophy, gentlemen. Philosophy is a challenge to the local prejudice, isn't it? And it says its truth regardless of the trend. I'll tell you my experience with a dean of a great university. Mrs. Hussey was having dinner, myself, with this gentleman in another house, and he said, "I don't understand your husband at all. What he's doing is against the trend." And she said, "Yes, that's why he is doing it." And he was at a loss. He had never heard of such a fool. "Well, that's my business, gentlemen. I'm a philosopher. So if I'm not against the trend, I sin. I'm a criminal. That's what I have taken an oath of as a doctor for, to tell the truth against the trend. It's not interesting to be with the trend, gentlemen. That's, you see. Didn't I tell you, that I was statistically unimportant? That's the business of philosophy, gentlemen, to be statistically unimportant. Because otherwise, the statistically important ones would have no future. Because they would then live from one trend to the next. And the trend would be not of their own making, but they would, of course, always just be trended. In other words, you will live, if you go by the trend, you live by accident. You become not master of your destiny. This old word, which today is quoted but never acted upon, you are the captain of your soul, means exactly this attempt to be free from the trend. To win against the trend. You have to know the trend, sure, but you have to laugh at it. And you have to, you may argue, you have to bring yourself into in a position so that you can survive it.
Must the trend always be wrong, sir?
No, but as a trend it is wrong. If you only do it because it is a trend, this is nonsense. You must have made the trend. If it is your trend, of course, then you can triumph. You see. Oh no, nothing is good or evil. Thinking makes it so. You know that. But it is, I mean, what do you say about an eastern wind? I mean, it is neither good nor evil, you see. So yeah, you won't go against the eastern wind, but you will also know not also not go with the eastern wind. It's you tack. You understand? It's not you. You cannot say that, you see, as here in this country where everybody feels that he must be part of the wind. Of this eastern wind. Or at least feign that he is. I mean, I think most people are so incredibly adroit that they, you see, they go to church because of Mr. McCarthy, and then they stop going to church when Mr. McCarthy has no power. That's what happened in this, and this whole thing is called a religious revival. No, you have forgotten this, perhaps, but it's only 4 years old. People suddenly got religion, at least on Sunday. Yeah?
Sir, if you continually go against the trend, are you not forming a trend of your own? In other words, aren't you...
No, sir. I, my dear man, you know this very well. It's the difference between a hybrid corn and weeds. The corn is meant to grow one day, but it doesn't go as a trend. It grows by a slow process of weeding. The weed would be the trend. I mean, any cultivated plant, of course, it has to grow and also respect the season, needs sunshine, rain, etc., sir. But you will never confuse wheat and weed.
Well, the thing is, what I was thinking is, if you make it a habit of going against the trend, I mean, you do tend to make it a habit when
no.
Says, well, I must go against the trend.
Oh, no. Well, that would be a negation that would make you dependent on the trend. Oh, heavens. Oh, no, my dear man. Certainly, you can't misinterpret me this way. You see, I didn't... You have to... There are deeper resources for knowing your direction, you see. But any mere trend is destructive for the community. That's obvious. That's why the country was very wise and has now a Democratic Congress and a Republican president, you see. I think that's an attempt of the Americans to get out of this trend business. Because no great republic can live, you see, the more foreign policy we have, the less we can afford to be swayed in one or the other direction, obviously. It is impossible. It's a very, you see, that is called conservatism. In this country there has never been conservatism, in the mind there couldn't be. And the problem, as you know, there have been some voices in the last 10 years trying to establish an American conservatism. But I have, has anybody read this book by a gentleman called Kirk? Who has read it? Is it popular? Well, poor man. He tried to be the standard bearer of a new conservative party in the United States. You haven't even heard of the man. Well, gentlemen, you are so reactionary, you don't have to. And this is a conservative country in a way, but the main essence I wanted to say about conservatism as a definition is that it tries to cap the trends so that they cannot go out of hand, you see. Whereas the left people are inclined to let the trend, you see, rule them. They are for the news, they are for the news, they are for support progress. And I think this is the real difference. The reactionary would be a man who just stops progress. That's not interesting, you see, there's always only a few. But the conservative already sees the next and the next trend, you see. and therefore says not one or any one of these trends must ride the crest of the wave totally. I think it's a very good definition of conservatism. If you do not see left and right as opposites, as you think, like a tug of war, one saying go forward, the other saying go backward. That's not the problem of a conservative party in England, for example, or of Disraeli, who was a real great conservative, you see. But the problem of the conservative is that he came because he is his father's son and because he remembers his grandfather gladly. He can see that what is of the day, you see, is not of the generation, and what is of the generation is not of the century, because these little crisscross of trends, you see, per diem and per annum and per generation, they cross each other out. And if you go totally in the zigzag, you see, of the trend, you waste an enormous amount. You have to burn and you destroy what you have to rebuild the next time. And as Robert Frost said, I couldn't afford to be a revolutionary in my youth, because then I would have had to be a reactionary at my old age. And I was afraid of that, that would then happen, you see. You understand? So that is why Robert Frost is a conservative, you see. That is, he wants to conserve the continuity despite the trend. These are, after all, important things, because you can see under what immense hazards the element of free criticism, the element of philosophy, this element of the autonomy of second impressions of criticism had to be implanted into every city, and that we at this moment feel, and that's I think the greatest danger we face today, and it isn't resolved at all yet, that the Russians have declared they are a philosophical government, their government has a philosophy, therefore nobody else can have a philosophy, because they have the right philosophy. And so in Russia you have pure Platonism, pure Parmenides ruling. It's a philosophical government. Its whole raison d'etre is philosophy. But if you make philosophy the basis of the government instead of the basis of the school or the academy or the philosophy criticizing the state, you get tyranny. You get a terrible state. You must never forget that Bolshevism is a philosophy. And we cannot shun the responsibility for it. It's Platonism. The Russians are Platonists in a certain, to a great extent. All that tyranny can be derived at by reading Plato's Republic. I would forbid the reading of Plato's Republic for the next 100 years, lest we lose our democracy. Because Plato justifies every measure of violence against disobedient citizens here in no uncertain terms. Fortunately, the philosopher, you see, because Plato says, if the philosophers become kings, you see, then everything is fine, you see. Well, everything is wonderful then for his philosophy, but everything is terrible for the man who has to live by it and doesn't agree. Because if one philosophy, which is the mood of the mind, governs, you see, then all the other moods of the mind are just excluded. This point is as important. There are two things then I wanted to start with today. One is that the Greek element of philosophy had to be added to the Christian missions. They had to be vaccinated equipped with this thorn in order to become a civilized nation. And there is an absolute defined term to nations, gentlemen, which you always omit in this country, and that's why you cannot deal with these problems of the Arab states, or the problems of Africa, or the problems in South America. You see, Bolivia and Paraguay are not nations. That is utter nonsense. They may be governments, and certainly misgovernments, but they are accidents yet. They are not necessary to the human race. They have not proved it, because nothing happens there in the conversation between ultimate truth and the local people. They are not part and parcel of the whole group that moves forward in the common spirit. And as long as they aren't this, they must be conquered. They must be ruled. They must be determined by others. Your idea of self-determination stems from groups, you see, like the German colonists who had Donald Andrews in the Puritan system. That's why this small handful of clergymen in this country, it makes America into something different from the five nations of the Indians. You can sink down to this level very soon. Just overnight you can. And you don't know this danger, gentlemen. You think that this is granted to you that you are in the avant-garde of civilization. Gentlemen, that's not true. In the last 10 years, America has been in great danger that this would not be true any longer. You can become powerful. You can excise, castrate your mind, and you can destroy the window through which you converse with the rest of the world. If you have not this decent respect for the opinions of mankind from the Declaration of Independence, this country is just as barbarous as any other. In itself, a parochial group does not deserve to be spared conquered. You must understand that the world is made only for those people who belong to the whole group of mankind, the human race. They must do something about it. Just by speaking what you call English in Chicago through your nose, you are not citizens of the world. That's just a group language. That's parochial. And any group, gentlemen, that separates itself from the tree of the whole human race has to be wiped out. It has been wiped out. That's the history of mankind. You don't think that the aborigines in Australia can live on. They just die out. In Tasmania, they have got a disease. They just die out there. And here, what about the reservation? It's not accidental, gentlemen. These people could not find any translating process by which they revamped their five nations into a part of the future human society. That's very difficult, but the life of mankind, gentlemen, isn't as happy-go-lucky as you think. Please look at the tragedy of the Red Indians in this country, and look at the Incas, and look at the Aztecs, and Montezuma. And now look at Hungary, gentlemen. The danger at every moment is tremendous. That whole parts of the human race are wiped out. Well, one of the ways of preserving the unity of the human race, I don't say the only one, has been this international power of philosophy. It is only in addition, as the Greek word international shows, to the life of the nation that you need this. You see, international, after all, is only something that is second. And never think that international powers can take the place of national powers. I know that. But a civilized nation is a nation that has international processes entering its own education, for example. If you have a history book in the United States which is pure propaganda against Russia, you will admit that you are beginning to cease to be a civilized nation. You understand? Because in this history book you cannot afford, although the Russians would not interfere. You can, but you may not. So definitely philosophy tries to inculcate into the educators and rulers of any polis, that is, any political unit. I must introduce this word, and if you understand, it means just as well the United States as it means Athens or Sparta or Rome. The philosopher introduces into the polis a standard of truthfulness. And therefore insists that many political acts can be done, but they may not be done. You see? And the important acts which cannot be done, which the philosopher in truth, so to speak, inculcates, are of course those which do harm to other polis. You see? Because, as you know, the priest of any religion in your own country, they cannot resist that temptation. All people preach to those who are in church. And those who happen to be absent or even belong to another church I never dealt with theory. But if the historian, you see, knows what the truth is, then he will not write a textbook, you see, in the school, which could be introduced gladly, you see, but may not be introduced for the purpose. Some of the textbooks used in our school, gentlemen, are certainly not truthful. But they are recommended by Mr. McCarthy. In every minute, gentlemen, this process happens. You think, of course, there's progress and these things cannot happen to us. Gentlemen, they have happened in the last 5 years. There has been a considerable recession in truthfulness, in veracity in our textbooks. That is, certain things have said, been said a little less and still a little less, and other things have been said a little more loudly, etc. For example, I'm always puzzled with the tradition in this country about the 300,000 loyalists which left this country, and where all the good citizens living in America at that time in 1776. Now, you know what happened to the president of Columbia University at that time? Who is from New York? How was Columbia called at that time?
King's College.
Yes. And what happened to the president? You know? Well, he had to jump out of the window and run for his life, and he went to Canada. It would be just the same as if, take President Conan or President Dickey. If he, in such a crisis, you see, it happened to him. You can hardly imagine, because you think Mr. Dickey will always be on the right side. You are such conformists today. But then, you see, all the good people were on the wrong side. All the Dickies. Yes. And you know, we lost the president at Dartmouth College. When did we lose our last president for a political affair?
Civil War.
Who was he? Nathaniel Wood Lawton. Why?
He was for slavery.
Oh, he was for slavery. Proved it from the Bible. I feel that the textbooks should be full of these examples to show how difficult life is. You see, how grave the decisions are. If you live through the 4th of July all your life without ever hearing that 300,000 of the wealthiest, best, and most important citizens had to leave this country, lost all their fortunes, their houses were broken, burned, their belongings were destroyed. If you never plastically see this happen, gentlemen, how do you know what the price of a revolution is? How can you esteem what the founders of this country ever did? And how can you ever get out of your own softness? Why is America so soft? Because of the school books, because of the little schoolhouse, because of the sweetness and light in these houses. With some spanking, you would know how hard it is to live. You never are spanked. A friend of mine went to England after the war. She was a German girl and the daughter and the granddaughter of a famous scientist. And she came to a Quaker college, Woodbrook. And she was well received. And one day, however, it was in 1920, only 2 years after Versailles and after the First World War. And so people were still quite exasperated in many respects. And so people pounded on the Germans, and she got very mad. And when one of these sweetness and light girls in this from this Quaker college said something nasty about Germany, she slapped her in the face. Silence. Quaker college had never happened before. No resistance. So she locked herself into her room for 3 days, and they shoved some tea into it, and after 3 days, Miss Sturge, that's a famous Quaker family, asked her, the principal asked her to come down, and tears in her eyes, Miss Sturge said, "Now, my dear Miss Henning, what are we going to do? This has never happened in Woodbrook, and I'm terribly sorry. And what do you say?" "Well," Miss Henning said, "something very simple." She said, "Miss Sturge, have you ever felt like slapping anybody in the face?" And Miss Sturge said, "No." And Miss Henning said, "That's the whole story." That's all the story. Story ends. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Wrong education.
I went to a Quaker school.
See?
I said I went to a Quaker school.
Yeah. Well, but you see my point?
Yeah, I see your point.
Well, the 300,000 loyalists are people who you see, represent the roughness, the toughness of real life, of passionate life, you see. Because the people slapped these people in the face. They did, indeed. And that's the price for the revolution. And it's the price for any revolution, gentlemen. And the idea that you can found new states without war or bloodshed is nonsense. And that is what probably is now destroying Israel, if Mr. Eisenhower gets through with his mad proposal. That this, it is mad. But I doubt that the Americans are just as cruel with their morality as the Russians in other ways. He may insist. I'm very, very concerned with this gentleman. States cannot, have never been founded by Rosewater. They cannot. It's an act of violence. So that others wake up and admit that they are state. I'm sorry, but the Pope, Pius II, a Pope after all, wrote in 1464 the great sentence, "Now the truth remains that never has a state been founded, nor shall it be founded without war." That's a Pope statement. And he knew what the world was like. And he said it when he convened the princes of the Western world against the Turks. It was after the fall of Byzantium, of Constantinople to the Turks. And he said, "You are all pacifists now, my dear gentlemen, but if you want to save the Western world, don't have illusions about the basis of nations, of national life. This illusion that you can send a lawyer, corporation lawyer, to draw up a contract and now then have a Gaza Strip or the desert or something as a frontier, it's all nonsense. You have to be there. And you have to risk your life for it. And you have to take a beating. And you don't like to hear this, most of you, because you have dreams of grandeur without grandeur, of peace without war. It doesn't exist. Peace and war are mutually relative terms, gentlemen. Peace is senseless without war. And war is senseless without peace, I grant you that. But you have to fight a war in order to have this problem of this war always end in a peace. The Americans have never given up territory conquered by in war. Now philosophy, gentlemen, is therefore the disagreeable truth, if it is anything, the disagreeable truth. That can be disagreeable in various respects. You can say that the earth turns around the sun. That was disagreeable to the people of the days of Copernicus, you see. That is, you can change the local aspect, the space aspect of the universe, or you can change the judgment of the times over its own goodness. It can be an ethical judgment, it can be a logical judgment, it can be a physical judgment, which you disprove as not valid, although it is parochially held. So there is an eternal, gentlemen, fight of any philosopher against the trends in the society, in the religion, and in the natural science of his day. You see, and that's why I insist, gentlemen, please believe me, that there cannot be common sense philosophers. One of the most frequent, how would I call this, reverses, I would say, of the definition of philosophy is at this moment rampant in America. There are even several books that are called Common Sense Philosophy. Gentlemen, philosophers have come into the world against common sense because common sense is the philosophy of yesterday, you see? What what you call common sense is the inherited philosophy. But it was common sense obviously in 1600 to say that the sun rose. And it was against the common sense that Kepler said it didn't, or Galilei. As gentlemen, your common sense is the common sense created into you by historical tradition. Every sense that anything makes to you is common sense, because you have inherited it. But don't forget that all your values have been created by philosophers. That is, people who stood on their head and said what the common sense of their days was not good enough. As long as you think that 160 million Americans can philosophize or are born philosophers and all men are equal with regard to philosophy, I'm very sorry for you, gentlemen. You haven't looked through this constant fight between common sense and abstruseness. And what is abstruse to you today is common sense tomorrow. But it can only become common sense tomorrow if it appears at one moment as abstruse. It isn't very difficult to understand this, gentlemen. That philosophers therefore must remain in the minority. They must not become kings. And what I'm doing today is to recapitulate now the story of Parmenides and the Sophists and Socrates with regard to the attempt which we find in Plato and in Aristotle to let the nation, the polis, be governed by the philosopher. That is Plato's dream, as you know. And you always read in the textbooks that unfortunately it was aborted. You see? It was very fortunate that it was aborted. Philosophy is an additional function which is needed. Don't misunderstand me, but it's so difficult for you to understand that it must never lead to the shortcut that the philosopher becomes king. Then you get the Bolshevik government. Mr. Lenin certainly was anything but a parochial man. He was an international philosopher of, and therefore he was so cruel. So brutal. No resistance. Because if you have not philosophy as a second order in which your mind is trained, then you use this mind to overrule all the facts of life, all the rights of other individuals, you see, all the given traditions of a community, you see. You just ride roughshod alone with your mind. And since we have philosophical government, gentlemen, we have today to divide again philosophy and government, and that's why I feel very strongly on this business of Platonism in which is rampant in our colleges. That can't go on, gentlemen, because Plato proclaims that philosophers should be kings. Now, it would be very nice for me if this was true, gentlemen. I would feel aggrandized, my whole class would grow up, but it is not so. Just as there is a division between church and state, gentlemen, there has to be interpolation, how shall one say, I think that's the best word, interpolation of two time phases between philosophy and the nation. Philosophy is the educational ferment of the national life that is anticipatory of change. But it is not able to rule itself. It must be sifted through all kind of very difficult processes until it has conquered the minds of men. Otherwise there will be bloodshed. Otherwise there must be barricades, you see. Otherwise there will roll tanks and destroy Budapest. That comes all. What's the good conscience of these ideologists? You see, what does this tyrant proclaim? Mr. Zublov and Mr. Kadar and all these people whom one doesn't know why the sun shines upon them. How can they kill all these people? Because they say it must be a communistic state. Now, what is a communistic state? It's a state sold to a philosophy of history, you see. To economic materialism, historical materialism, however you call it, economic, historical. And therefore, that's the only justification. Who does not think, not believe, but who does not think as we, you see, deserves to be killed. deserves to be not be allowed to send his children to a higher school as learning, as you know. If you are not a communist, you have no right that your child should get an education. All this follows by the nature of philosophy, if you put philosophy into the government of a country. This is, pardon me?
Don't you think that democratic government is also based on philosophy?
Yeah, but the self-denying ordinance of a democracy, a democratic government, is that the ruler must be an average man and not a philosopher. This is the difference you see between the American democracy or Swiss democracy on one side and the Bolshevik government. The party in Russia is exclusively known for the strictness of its party line. You see, that is the reason why a man is in power there. Here the reason is, you see, that even the party with some platform has to look for a popular man who is not sold to the party line at all. Woodrow Wilson wasn't, Roosevelt wasn't, you see, but who, the party machine in this country cannot nominate a machine man for the President of the United States, you see, because the people wouldn't vote for him. It has to be a free man, you see, who is not subservient to any such formal statement, or even of the party, and the party is already a watered-down philosophy, isn't it, and contains innumerable contradictions. So, the Democratic Party, a Republican Party, they really have not a homogeneous philosophy, you see. It's a hodgepodge of compromises, you see, of concessions to this group and the other group, etc. And attempt to put this compromise in such a frame that it looks as though it had any logic in it, you see. Then comes the party leader, the modern Republican, and says, sorry, but the whole platform is not for me. And he's elected. Isn't that true? So you see, the freedom of the president in the United States is a very real thing, that he is not fettered by what we would call a real philosophy. He's fettered, of course, by promises he makes, you see, by situations he faces, you understand. It is understood how we cope with certain situations, but that's not philosophy in the abstract. If he was sold to any maxim like eugenics or mercy killing, I wouldn't vote for him. Heaven forbid that we ever get a vegetarian president. But you understand? And the gravest mistake in the history of the United States was a prohibition issue, wasn't it? Why? Because that is a philosophical decision. There you can see, you see. What happens when women go to college. Please.
I don't understand the distinction you make, sir, between, on the one hand, the Russians crushing the Hungarians from a philosophical point of view, and the point of view that we would be justified in conquering the Uruguayans or the Ecuadorians because they are not in the real sense of nations.
I haven't said that we should conquer them, but I doubt that they can govern themselves. Tin governs Bolivia, and that's a very poor government, you know. I assure you, the speculative dependency of these poor countries, you see, on some economic hazard is very tragic. I think the history of Paraguay is the most tragic history of any country in the world. Have you ever read it? I recommend it to you. It is unbelievable. The history of Paraguay is an example of what the usurpation of state rights by a territory that is not able to claim it. What then happens? Who has been to South America? Where have you been? That's not far enough south. Unfortunately, I have never gone to Paraguay. I have friends who settled in Paraguay, the famous Hutterites, that are pacifists. They came here first from Germany, they're friends of mine in Germany. Then they went on to Paraguay when here the Second World War made it plausible that they would have to take up arms here. Very good people. And also the consul in Paraguay is a friend of mine. And so at least I have some direct connection with the, but I have also studied the history. You know, at one time there were perhaps two dozen males in Paraguay left. The rest were women and children. They'd all killed each other off in 1846. The history of Paraguay is really something you ought to study, gentlemen. If you want to be cured from your incredible optimism, you see, you all on the one hand side think you are cannot be taken in. On the other hand, you all believe in words, in mere words. If somebody calls himself a nation, you believe it. If Paraguay says, I'm an independent republic, you bow and say, well, then it must be so. If Nasser says, he's the legal government of Egypt, you accept it. And you will even have, we haven't broken up diplomatic relations with Hungary. Mr. Kadar, this butcher, you see, this provincial governor of a Russian province, will now pose as an independent government. I'm sure he will. And you accept and say, from now on, you will, and we will play even in Melbourne with these rascals, or in the Olympics, because that would be bad for the... Why doesn't the American Olympic team leave Melbourne right away? No, that would spoil the game. That you are word realists, that is, to you, a name, if it is not, is real. The word nation, self-determination of nations, instead of asking, is this a nation? That's the overwhelming question. Who is a nation, you should ask. You see, then that's why I threw out my definition. You can only grant the rights of nations to people who belong to some commonwealth of nations, you see. But if you take in Liberia, as we did in 1800, when it was it founded, Liberia? This is rotund Mr. Tubman, has a wonderful name, you know, I always think of a tub. He's president of Liberia, ex-president of Liberia, you see. They had slaves, these Negroes in Liberia, you see, they had. And the Americans didn't want to look into the matter, you see, how these American Negroes exploited the African Negroes, worse than any colony. But you think Liberia is a free republic, but the good treatment of the natives by the English administration, that doesn't count for anything. That's colonialism, you see. But why? Because the people who govern Liberia and abuse it are black. Tyrants they are. Horrid. We have done it. We have founded the state. And there are two classes. One is the American Negro in Liberia, and the other are the colonials. But nobody is allowed to mention this. In every European geographical magazine, you can see that the worst part of Africa is Liberia. Well, here it mustn't be said, because how can it? It's all wonderful, you see. It's an independent nation. It's the worst part of Africa. The Belgian Congo is heaven against it. But if it comes to an issue, you will vote for Liberia and against Belgian Congo. One is a colony and the other is a free country. God help you. When will you wake up to know what a nation is and what a government can be and what it is not? It's all just words. And therefore, I think the definition of a nation, I've given this in a work called the Autobiography of Western Man, it's very important, gentlemen, what has been sanctified in the law of nations and in the treatment of nations as a nation is a part of the history of the church, of Christianity. And it is very fashionable today to dismiss missions, to dismiss Christianity, to dismiss church as obsolete. I warn you, in politics it's still a very important practice to ask if this country has been, any country on the globe, has been educated by the freedom which comes only when you separate church and state. Because only in this separation, which has been produced by philosophy, can you speak of a civilization? As soon as Mr. Nasser is at the same time the religious leader of his people, you get an impossible situation. You can't cope with this man. He's a fanatic. The religious leader of the Muslim world has said to a friend of mine that every Israelite, I don't think I told you this, you see, child and baby in mother's womb has to be murdered. He says this now for 7 years to everybody who wants to visit him, day after day. Why isn't this printed in the letters here? That's a declaration much more than war, but of destruction. And that goes on day after day. Did I tell you this before?
Abdel Nasser is not the religious leader of the Arab people. Well,
he has tied now to inherit. Oh yes, you don't know this, but even the Vatican has made a pact with him on mutual toleration against bad bigot communism 6 years ago. That was very unfortunate. The Pope and then Farouk ended into such a situation, and Nasser has inherited it. You read his proclamations. The whole appeals to the Muslim world. So you may say he is not qualified by the tradition of Muslim, which has never recognized this, you see. But his language is, he has no other, since he has no legal basis for his government, you see. All illegal governments must make some spiritual claim, you see. They have to have some basis, you see. And Nasser has absolutely no right to govern except a coup, I mean, a coup d'etat. I mean, he just went there and dispossessed the king and said, now I rule. Then he dispossessed the first prime minister whom he nominated, you see, Mr. Naguib, and to whom Mr. Dulles gave a silver pistol, as you know, as a present, as an invitation to shoot. Well, I really, this is of course a quandary, gentlemen, of our great, of our time. It's a philosophical quandary, gentlemen, of a definition of a state, of a modern state, a modern polis, a modern nation. And you have to distinguish between statehood, that is some political concern, like, where shall we turn, like Panama or Guatemala, and a nation. I think even you would doubt for a minute if I said, is there a Panama nation? Of course there isn't. You see, there isn't, there's a state. It is a vassal state of the United States. That's all that is. That's not so little. But it is nonsense to say that the Panamese form a nation because some hirelings from America set up their government. When we needed it. It's an artificial thing, isn't it? It is not a nation. If you bring yourself, which is nearly impossible, it seems to me, for in your mental processes, to say Panama is not a nation, you have advanced to the necessary degree to understand the function of philosophy. Because it has pure told you that you cannot call everything a nation what you please to call a nation, what you want to call a nation. That you have to give it a certain minimum of reality, you see. Now, in the history of the human race, gentlemen, the nations of the Western world became nations through off the yoke of Pope and Emperor when they implanted into the heart of their own territory an institution of free criticism, an international institution. And that is called, gentlemen, the institution of higher learning. The word higher implies today what the Greeks called mind, first by philosophy and later by the academy and later by this eranos, this group of lovers. Gentlemen, the word higher means sovereign. And a school of higher learning is sovereign with regards to the laws of the state in which it roams. It can criticize them. And therefore, a state plus an institution of higher learning, that's perhaps the simplest definition, you see, which it tolerates not only, but which it recognizes as necessary to its own improvement. Such an institution is a nation. That minimum of separation of church and state, you see, of separation of reverence and criticism, without which you don't have to have great respect for the boundaries of which you dispose of. Now, the Americans will be challenged to dispose of Trieste not only, but of the Polish issue, of the German issue, of the poor. Everything comes important to the Americans. If you have no criteria to judge these issues, if you do not at least understand the distinction between a group, batch of people who live in a suburb of the world, like Alexandria or Cairo, and a nation. And a nation must have an institution of higher learning to criticize its own law before it doesn't participate in the community of nations. And that's much more important in the long run, gentlemen, than the having embassies. You can imitate all these things, you see. You can put Mr. Tubman, president of Liberia, into a tuxedo, you see, and then say he's president of Liberia. But that's your own illusion, gentlemen, and it will be to our own disadvantage if you are coaxed into these errors by simply the usage of words. Now, why do I say all these things, gentlemen? I say it in preparation to the tremendous function of Greek philosophy in forcing the individual city, in forcing the individual city to criticize its terms, you see, to define its terms. You say always define the terms. Now, that's a philosophical victory over the city, you see. In when you are one of ours, when you are just a member of the parochial community, you do never have to define your terms because you speak as everybody else does, you see. There's no necessity of defining your terms. The term define your terms, in other words, is the way by which the city has lost her sovereign jurisdiction to some higher areopagos, judicial court, but in front of which it has to justify itself. And gentlemen, don't forget that this decent respect for the opinion of mankind is a strictly philosophical expression. The United States, when they were born as a part of a world in which a conversation goes on between the minds, you see. And you cannot set up house. A son cannot set up house if he denies that he will be one house in the community, and therefore take over the orders of his father's house in a certain extent into his house. You cannot claim without recognizing other people's precedent. And marriage is impossible, gentlemen, if you do not accept for yourself the obligations to do likewise, to set up house. And a nation cannot set up house if it doesn't accept to do likewise. You know the problem of Spain. Protestants cannot live in Spain. That's for our notions impossible. You cannot leave the Catholic Church in Spain. There's a border, and that's why Spain, to a certain extent, is not a civilized nation. It isn't. It is fossil. It's purely accidental. Everybody there is a Roman Catholic. I would say, therefore, nobody is a Christian. Because you cannot only be a Christian if there's a possibility of being not a Christian. In New York, they called a school Stepinat School. Have you heard of this? Who knows the Stepinat School in New York? Well, I just talked to a man from Croatia whose mother was forced by Mr. Stepinac, Archbishop of Zagreb, to become a Roman Catholic by violence. He was here, she was left alone there, the old woman, and they said to her that she would have to migrate on foot 500 miles to Serbia unless she became, she was a Greek Catholic, you see. She was a good Christian, a Roman Catholic. And she was one of thousands and thousands. Now, the Americans are so stupid that this bloody great inquisitioner, who should be burned at stake himself, this Mr. Stepinac, is worshipped as a saint in New York City. Well, that's the electorate of New York. These are the voters of New York. It's the most unenlightened group I've ever known. Stepinac is a saint in New York. A man who forces people, now for New York that means something. I mean, that's the issue of issues in New York, that religion should be free, isn't it? Even Mr. Spellman has to admit it. It comes hard to him. It's a scandal, gentlemen. And nobody has protested in this country. But I have a friend whose mother has been forced to change her religion, and the school in New York is called after this tyrant. So wake up to the fact, gentlemen, that we are very backward, gentlemen. That philosophy does not play the necessary role at this moment in America. that you take everything just at face value as a journalist does. And journalism, gentlemen, is the curse of this country. All the news are wrong. They are all right and wrong, but they are not true, because the words are, the Hungarians are called in rebels and insurgents in this country. Can you imagine what harm has been done by this simple use or in the New York Times of the word rebels for the Hungarian people? How can we call them rebels? Against whom are they rebels? Against the Russians? Is this rebellion? It's a simple, there you see, if you don't define your terms, gentlemen, if you have no philosophy, the city is lost. And poor Hungary, I think you might have gotten the Americans to do something if the telegrams hadn't been all slandered and all for fortnight now only said that rebels were insurging in the streets of Budapest. It was a legitimate government of Mr. Nari and Tildy who's fighting. And you call these people rebels? And that goes on here, nobody says anything. Everybody eats up these drugs, this venom, and this poison. Because you're just not, these newspaper people, you can do with you what they please. What comes first into their inkstand, it's done. The Europeans have never done this. There's not, you see the demonstration in Paris. And the wreckage of the communist headquarters in Paris today in the papers. I get my news, of course, from my homeland, from Germany, and I get it from Switzerland. And I get it from England, by the way, but accidentally too. All Europe is in an uproar, but of course these people are saying, they are never mentioning that these people are rebels. They are the legitimate citizens of Hungary and the legitimate government. Yeah? Exactly, would be a much better word. Oh, the citizen army. I mean, whatever, you cannot call them rebels because you have brought up the people here, as you see, they are such conformists now. Rebels? Unfortunately, we can't do anything because the legitimate government is putting down a rebellion. That's within the international law. Don't you see the difference? As soon as you call them rebellions, we have no ways of saying to the Russians, stop it. Again, rebellion has to be crushed. Any rebellion.
What about revolution?
It's not a revolution. It's not a revolution. If you throw out an invading army, that's not a revolution.
Well, when you have the original government, these people fought against and now being put down.
Now, that's of course a very involved and very long story, because we allowed, of course, against Churchill's will, we sacrificed the whole east of Europe. I mean, if we had remained in Prague, all this couldn't happen. I mean, the Americans, after all, have done this all. We were in Prague. We had conquered Prague, as you may know. And who has Prague has Europe, is an old saying, which unfortunately no American schoolchild ever learned. And since the Russians have Prague, they have Europe. And we have done this against the warnings of everybody on the continent of Europe, you see. I have a friend who went to, from Germany, Count Molto, who went to 44 to Constantinople at the risk of his life, which was then in the German orbit, trying to see Americans, to tell them that there was still a chance to keep the Russians out of Europe if Germany could, if they only would land there in the east, and then they could own the whole of Europe. Of course, he couldn't get through. The hatred was far too much to listen to such an argument. The memorandum was brought out only a very short time ago into this country now. Nobody, the FBI simply didn't, the agents of the Mr. Allen Dulles didn't think fit even to communicate with such a reasonable proposal. So it's all our own making, gentlemen. Hungary would, of course, be in our camp to this day, and perhaps not Warsaw, that is hard to say, but certainly there would be no eastern zone of Germany if we had just done what our military power demanded us to do. You won't know this, of course, that our troops were in Prague. So who has Prague has also Budapest. That's the real thing. That's why you asked me about the legal government, you see. It's after all an occupation army. Never forget this, you see. And everything that goes in under an occupation is, of course, not legal. You see? It's just there. It's de facto, of course, that the thing is called, you see. It's a thing of fact, but not of law. You can understand. Now, all the governments there derive their power, therefore, from this military occupation, which was a joint occupation, after all, of Americans and Russians. And I mean, how we divided it is another matter, but that's how it was done. So this joint occupation of Europe by the victors, America and Russia, broke down, as I read it, 3 weeks ago, when it showed that our plein pouvoir, our decision to let the Russians do as they please in the east of Europe, came to an end because the people of Hungary wouldn't stand it. And there was, they set up a government which was recognized by the Russians, as you know. It was, you see. They dealt with Mr. Nagy as the legal government. At that moment, I think, you had the first post-war government of Hungary in its own right. You see? That was what it was said. It was the awakening, just as Eden's and Alphonse or Molle's own step in Suez was the awakening of Western Europe from the servitude towards the United States. So in the East, Poland and Hungary and Tito, I mean, woke up and said, we are still after, we have some life of our own, what you see. And therefore, I feel that this is the legal government. And then, for reasons which I cannot distinguish, cannot tell you, and probably nobody knows, the Russians suddenly veered in the opposite direction and said, that's too dangerous for us, you see. That sets an example which we cannot possibly tolerate, and they have made no bones that this new government is of their making, you see. Now, you can of course claim that they still have the rights of an occupation, army of occupation, but they don't claim that. That's the interesting thing. Yes, I would say, well, the victors, you see, this is the same situation in 45. But for, strangely enough, the Russian, these new Hungarian tyrants, this Mr. Kadar, as far as I can make out, does not claim that this comes all from the Russian occupation in the war, you see. So he has given up the only possible logic which would make his government into an understandable government, you see. And he makes no bones that he is simply there at the behest of the Russians as a communistic government. So that's a civilian ideology. That's a peacetime ideology, you see, communism. That has nothing to do with conquest. Now, strange enough, you will say I'm a strange fellow. I think that in a war, a victor is entitled to set up a government. I don't think that's the essence of war that leads to such things. Whereas I hate to see a philosopher set up a government because he's a communist. You see the difference? So I think the communistic government, which now says it is there because Russia cannot tolerate a non-communistic state, is infinitely more cruel then the reason that I have been provoked by Hitler, as he certainly was, you see, and I have invaded his satellites and I have set up a government in Hungary in order to satisfy my victory, to fit my victory. This, I think, would lead to a better treatment of Hungary, you know, mere occupation, than the harsh brutality of a philosophy of government. See the difference? That the strange thing is that this is claimed by the Russians and by the new Zizner and their henchmen in Hungary, that they have to be there because they have to have communism. No military security adduced, you see, just communism. And that's why I warn you, a philosopher as king is the worst man you can have.
What? Mr. Kadar is a traitor to Hungary?
Oh, my dear man, you don't know how I feel about this word. They just published 3 days ago in Germany two letters, open letters of mine about this term treason. I still haven't heard of the reaction, but it's quite a document. You know, treason has occupied my own mind for the last 35 years very deeply. And since 1918, how long is this? It's nearly 40 years, isn't it? And so there is this moment in Germany are two little volumes in circulation and have been sold out like hot potatoes on treason. And they have lumped together all people, you see, who have ever been suspected of treason in the last 30 years, which is quite a number, in all countries of Europe. And Ezra Pound is in it too, for example, you see. And so the issue which you raise is a tremendous issue. When is the loyalty, you see, of an existing order exhausted to an existing order, you see, exhausted? Mr. Kada was formed in Moscow. Now, the one thing the Ignatius Loyola School of Secular Jesuitism in Moscow does, the first doctrine is that nations are there to be used as tools, that you must have yourself complete indifference to any national issue. Therefore, they take Hungarians under one condition, that they cease to be Hungarians. They take Germans, same, Americans, you see, under one condition, that they rise above the nation, because they say, and I think that's very logical, and I think you can't blame them, we are a world revolution. The condition of our victory is that our staff, the communists, are totally indifferent to nations. And that is such an urgent matter for the communists, because in 1914, gentlemen, all socialist parties, all Marxian parties on the continent of Europe voted, including Mr. Kerensky, for the national war. Mr. Jaurès, the one French leader who was against the war, was shot dead on the eve of the outbreak of the war. The German Social Democrats, who were violently anti-militarists, voted for the credits for the war. The English Labour Party, of course, did. The Italian Socialists did. That is, in all Europe, the Socialist parties proved their patriotism, you see, and went with the existing order. The Lenin and the so-called group of Zimmerwald in Switzerland, that there was a small group of 12 international communists, said, therefore, the Second International has betrayed the workers. The workers are against war for capitalistic, nationalistic reasons. Therefore, that was in 1916, we have to get together and found a Third International. And the Third International is based on one and one only sole item as against the Second, you see. That not one of us must be interested in nations. Therefore, when Mr. Kada goes to Moscow, it means that he ceases to be an Hungarian, but becomes qualified to govern Hungarians, you see, from the viewpoint of the Third International. That's, therefore, you can hardly ask me, is he a traitor? The question is, when did he become one?
He's a philosopher.
He?
He's a philosopher.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Do you understand? He doesn't become a traitor now, you see. But if you were, and that's, I think, why we are right to say a member of the Communist Party plots the downfall of the American government. It really does. Or it is not a communist member of the Communist Party. You see, it's begging the question what you're asking me. If you are a real communist, not a run-of-the-mill communist, but a trained communist, the first thing is, you see, that you are circumcised and that the term nation will find no echo any longer in your heart. Can you see this?
Yes.
No, who asked the question?
I did.
Oh, you did. I thought you were sick. There were many fond of it.
He is also not a member of the Chinese government.
Kada wasn't, no. No, he was not in his government.
Well,
he was before. Gero and Kadar were the Moscow instructed people, and not, as far as I know, I will not quibble. Do you think Kadar was in his government?
I think he was. Without was his party secretary or something like that?
Well, I don't know the details. You, of course, you know, in the Russian system, the janitor of the embassy is always more important than the ambassador because he is the man who spies on the ambassador. That's true. So, I don't know the details of their order, but if Mr. Nagy had to keep Kedar, it showed this weakness of probably that he felt. Otherwise, the Russians would march in. He probably had him as a safety valve, don't you think? But then he was overthrown by Kedar, obviously. Well, gentlemen, I have tried to show you, to tell you or to warn you that this history of philosophy has to deal with, this is a very practical issue. The globe is peopled today by states who are civilized in as far as their civilization. What we call civilization comes from city. Never forget that, you see. From the ancient city of the Greeks, polis. City is the translation of polis. Most people, you squander this term civilization, something rather simple. A group of civilized people is a people who have made special arrangements that the talk of the town shall contain an element of international conversation. You see, of inter-town conversation. In a serious way, not gossiping, not talk, not news, but so that the viewpoints of the rest of the world are heard in the education of the citizens. You understand? And it is always, can be lost every minute, this qualification. And it has to be restored all the time by philosophers who are beheaded for this purpose. You know, as Socrates have to drink the cup of hemlock. Don't believe that you will be spared, gentlemen. You will either poison or be poisoned. Nobody can be impartial in this game of civilization, gentlemen. Don't think that at the end of your life you can say, I did nothing bad and nothing wrong. You will either have helped this international conversation to continue or to be bettered and improved and sharpened, or to have it less effective and to go parochial. And nobody is neutral in this. With every decision to which school you send your children, how much money you give to the school teacher, you decide these issues. Because the way you treat your school teachers, these poor people, of course, have to dance at your whistle, at your whim. I mean, there is no independence of the schools in this country. The school boards rule them from their prejudices. And there are no institutions of higher learning that are really free. And men like Mr. Oppenheimer could be excluded from the councils of this nation just like that, by whim of the president. Our president doesn't see philosophers, he sees presidents of Coca-Cola companies. He doesn't speak to any men of wit, of insight, of wisdom, of independent judgment, of international judgment. He doesn't want to. He doesn't read books, he doesn't read papers. So he's very much immunized, of course. And if I had a free ballot, of course, I couldn't do it. I would have voted for Sherman Adams. Thank you.